get up and do my thing. I want to get into it, man, you know. Like, you know I'm the man, don't you? Can I count it off? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Politics podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibbons. You can get in-depth political analysis from a Christian worldview, transcend partisanship and political ideology with us as we seek true discipleship.
I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave, I'm unchained, I'm Frederick Douglass with a fade.
This is the Church Politics Podcast with Michael Ware and Justin Gibney. Justin, how are you?
I can't complain. Had a good week, ready to talk about some politics, brother.
Yeah, man. I just got back. I was at a conference in Florida, so got Melissa was able to come, got some beach time with Melissa, and was just able to talk with some great people about a hope in public life, and so had a blast. But I have been all throughout the conference, I was looking forward to getting back to DC to record this podcast with you, because I, as folks know, I love talking with you, but B, we have an amazing guest, a good That's friend right. of mine. Matt Lewis is our guest today. Matt is a senior columnist at the Daily Beast, a CNN political commentator, and the author of a tremendous book that was, you had the sense when it came out that it was prescient. And Matt's really been proven to be prescient in what he saw happening in the party. He's the author of Too Dumb to Fail, How the GOP Betrayed the Reagan Revolution to win Elections and How It Can Reclaim Its Conservative Roots. Matt, I'm so happy to have you on, brother.
Hey, thank you.
Great. It's Matt. I think the way we just want to open it up is, just tell folks a little bit about your book, why you wrote it. I know you released a new edition that sort of brought it into the Trump era. And so, you know, what, if anything, has changed about your view of the Republican Party? And just tell folks about the backdrop of your book.
Sure. So I would say around 2010, I was at AOL's Politics Daily, which is now defunct. And I started seeing things in the Republican Party that were bothering me. This is around the time that the Tea Party started. And you had people like Sarah Palin, who were kind of out getting a little radical. You had candidates like Christine O'Donnell and Sharon Angle that were really, I think, dumbing down politics and playing this populist card that to me was very unconservative. And this was the first time that I had kind of strayed from, you know, conservative orthodoxy. They were the ones straying in my opinion. But this is the first time that I was like at odds with, you know, really at odds with like the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
Yeah.
And I started writing about that in 2010, and it led to this book. My book came out January of 2016, and it was basically a warning against this brand of dumbed down conservatism that had sort of manifest itself, metastasized, I would say, into Donald Trump. And of course, everybody, I think I was right about so much, but the Republican Party promptly ignored everything I told them to do and did the opposite. And of course, Donald Trump ended up winning. And the only good thing about that is that it proved my title, Too Dumb to Fail, was actually correct.
Yeah.
Interesting. Matt, I was reading one of your recent articles, and I am going to get to the book. I haven't had a chance to go through it yet, but I'm going to grab that. You had a quote in one of your recent articles that said this. It said, Trump is a symptom, not a cause. In supporting Trump, GOP voters were recognizing reality, not endorsing it. Bad behavior has become good politics. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
Yeah. So as I was saying with my book, I started writing the book in 2010, not writing the book, but writing the columns, the critique of the right that turned into the book. And so long before Donald Trump ran for president, there were problems. There was a Republican Party that was having an identity crisis, didn't know what it believed in. was playing the victim card, was straying from things that I sort of brand of conservatism that I believe in. I voted, by the way, just full disclosure, I voted for Marco Rubio in the Virginia primary. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. Yeah. Having said that, so I think Donald Trump is not a good person. And you know, I didn't vote for him, or I just didn't vote. It's the first time I didn't vote in a presidential election. I just couldn't in good conscience vote for this man. Aside from the fact that I have problems with some of his policies, I just don't think he's not really a man of character in my estimation. Having said that, it would be wrong to like attribute to him all these problems. They right. pre-existed him. I think he capitalized on them. I think he sort of seized this opportunity because of these problems. And I would say I do think that some of the people who voted for him because they realized that politics is broken and they'd given up hope on actually electing a good person. And they were really settling for him.
Yeah, that's really my sense, Matt. I think there's a lot of there was a lot of complacency and sort of accommodation to the brokenness and the corruption that people saw in politics, and so they were willing to accommodate themselves to someone like Donald Trump. But Matt, you know, we're both in D.C., and you know, we have a lot of friends who have been in the Republican Party for a long time, and there was just this sense that one of the things that surprised them about Trump's rise was to learn that the Republican base maybe isn't as attached to the principles that they thought were at the foundation of the party, that maybe sort of trade wasn't as important as some of the party leaders thought it was to their base. Maybe having candidates of moral character and sort of family values candidates weren't as important as they thought it would be. And so, you know, I think one of the problems facing the Republican Party as it tries to, I think as it sees the problems with Trump and modeling a party on Trump's politics is so much of the base likes it that you have a split base, that it's not just sort of a fight among elites and an insurgent that the Republican Party is really, really fractured. So how you reconcile? I mean, we saw this in Virginia, right, where you had Corey Stewart, who's, you know, a ethno-nationalist who was spent his campaign defending the Confederate memorials and Confederate flag. You had him take Ed Gillespie down to the wire. And so just talk to us a little bit about, how the Republican Party moves forward when its base is so, so fractured.
Yeah. I mean, we get the politicians we deserve, basically. And that's the problem. I mean, that's the problem with like democracy, right? Yeah. You know, John Adams and the founding fathers saw this long ago that only a sort of a virtuous and moral people could, you know, could really handle this republic. And that's the scary part. Look, I would say a few things. One, I think that America in general is a product of a reality TV world, and the Republican Party is not immune to that. So part of what we're seeing is the manifestation, I think, of a culture that is coarsened, where we have a reality TV president. I think that's part of it. I think there's also, and this goes back to the last question about, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. I do think there's a sense, a sense of victimhood amongst conservatives, that they believe that the media is out to get them, the media is biased, and that it takes someone, you have to fight fire with fire. Look, we saw what happened to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was a really decent man I wasn't a huge Romney fan, but, you know, remember he was trying to like help hire women and he right. made this stupid line about binders full of women. And it was really viciously used against him, you know, in this war on women. So I think there yeah. were some people who said, look, being a nice guy, being, you know, sort of being honorable, like that doesn't win. This is an existential Hillary Clinton. This is their in their mind is an existential threat. We can't afford four more years. We've just had eight. We have to do what we have to do. But the last thing I'll say is that I completely agree that I was among those who didn't fully appreciate the fact that the vast majority of rank and file conservative voters don't really know that much or care that much about conservative philosophy. It's much more about tribalism to them, sort of who's on their team. And sadly, I think more and more it's coming down a racial line. It's also like, you know, there's some pretty clear predictors. Like if you have a college degree, you're less likely to vote for Trump. But I think the race issue is one that has gotten worse. I mean, you know, there's a chance we could have had, I'm not saying this would have changed everything overnight, but remember the Benetton ad? I mean, there was a chance that there was a moment there where you had Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, was on a stage with Tim Scott. I think he was at the time the only African-American senator. Nikki Haley, the daughter of immigrants. And I think it was it Mick Mulvaney or somebody else? I mean, so it was really and they were all conservative. And that could have been the future. We went with Donald Trump instead.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, just to kind of go on, and I'm gonna hold on to this for a little longer, so bear with me. But hating the players, can we really avoid blaming the players who in some way create the game? Because at some level, don't they have a responsibility to correct it? I mean, they're not just mindless folks just walking around reacting to their circumstances. They have to think through these things. And the truth of the matter is, when it comes to principle, it can't be all about winning. So what I'm hearing is there was an understanding in order to win, we had to support, you know, certain people had to support Trump or whatever.
Yeah.
But at some point, right, they have to be blamed for a lack of principle if those principles were violated and to correct them.
Yeah. So, I mean, I definitely think that we need to hold our elites responsible, you know, whether that's opinion leaders or party officials or politicians themselves. And I think that they have a responsibility to do the right thing as they see it. I guess my point is that in our form of government, eventually we will get the politicians that we deserve because they're responding to incentives. They're responding to incentives. They're trying to get reelected. They want to give us what we want. And so I think that it's a lagging indicator. We're sort of living off the borrowed capital of Christian civilization. And it's a lagging indicator, but I think that, you know, when did it was probably 1992 when the first American reality show started. What was it on MTV? I can't remember. Ritual Campus.
Real World. Real World.
Yeah.
Real World.
And obviously we had Bill Clinton who had some elements of that, you know, sort of showmanship and all that. But, you know, I think that we've now gotten Donald Trump is, you know, it took a couple decades, but this is where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt, you mentioned sort of Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Marco Rubio, you know, the future of the party. And, you know, I think that was a central message of Rubio's campaign. I think even, you know, Jeb Bush had, you know, the central paradox of his campaign, which was, you know, he was trying to convey a vision for the future of the Republican Party when he was, you know, distinctly, explicitly tied to its past. But you had multiple candidates trying to put forward a 21st century vision for the Republican Party. And they all got knocked down. On what do you think it will take, or do you think that Trump has set the party back, a generation or decades, on sort of pivoting towards the 21st century? Or to be more bleak about it, is Trump really showing the Republican Party the way to win in the 21st century? And it's just, not a positive path forward. is Rubio and Jeb Bush and Arthur Brooks, are they the ones who don't get the times?
Well, so I think it's if we learned anything from Trump's election, it's that it's so hard to predict what's going to happen. But if I had to bet, then I would bet that in the short term, at least, the Trumpists have won the Republican Party. They've won the argument in the short term. I think in the long run, it's a very bad move for the Republican Party for a variety of reasons, including demographic reasons. But in the short term, I think that that very clearly the Marco Rubios and the Arthur Brookses, they're the ones who are out of touch with the Republican Party. And I think that's a sad commentary. I think it didn't have to be this way, but that is where we are. It's very clearly we're to a certain extent following a European model. And my only hope is that, as has been the case through much of our history, we just get a small dose of what Europe is getting, and that we don't actually become sort of indefinitely this situation where we have this white identity politics kind of right wing populist party that takes over the party of Reagan.
Right.
I think another good question is, with this new Republican Party that you've described, the next question is going to be, can they govern? So what can we expect, or what do you expect them to be able to accomplish this term? We know that a lot of times administrations pass their biggest legislation early on. This administration has suffered. But what do you see them being able to do, if anything, in this term?
Yeah, really nothing much. Maybe they'll do some sort of pared down tax reform. I don't think they're going to get, they're certainly not going to get anything like Reagan was able to get in his big, tax reform bill. Which was like a landmark accomplishment, but maybe they'll be able to pass some sort of tax reform. But yeah, it's very anemic. It's quite pathetic when you consider the ambition that they had to really repeal Obamacare, do tax reform, do infrastructure, and do it all basically. You need to do it very quickly if you want to do it. So, but I would say I don't think this is actually part of the argument for Trump, which is to say, a normal politician, say like a Rubio or a Jeb Bush, like maybe they would have been able to build a coalition and have some bipartisan buy-in, or they would have just been more competent and they would have been able to pass things. But Trump basically just flips the script and says there's a new paradigm. All the assumptions are out the window. And he would basically say, like, who cares that we didn't do anything? This is about a culture war. This isn't about, putting points on the board with legislation. This is about making sure people say Merry Christmas, and to a certain degree, he's going to get away with it, at least with his supporters.
Interesting. So, Matt, do you see that? Go ahead.
Oh, no. Follow up on that, Justin.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. So we have a situation where nothing, most people are predicting that nothing will be done. Do you see the Democratic Party, as me and Brother Weir are Democrats, do you see them as being in a position to capitalize on that?
Not fully. No. it's so interesting. You know, it's almost like the Cubs Nationals game the other night, you know, where like nobody deserves to win the game.
Too soon, Matt. Too soon.
They're both trying to lose. I will say, even though, you know, even though I'm not a Trump supporter, and I did, you know, I wrote the book that sort of predicted all of this, but I underestimated some of Trump's appeal in terms of winning the general election and all that. But I do have a pretty good sense, I think, of the Trump voter. You know, I'm from a really rural area in Western Maryland. My dad was a prison guard for like 30 years. My mom lives in Pennsylvania and drove people to the polls for Donald Trump to win Pennsylvania. So, like, you know, I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of that base. The Democrats, I don't get to the same degree. All I can see is that they have not, you know, they have not fully capitalized. And clearly they have, they're wrestling with, you know, do they want to sort of stay in the mainstream with the Barack Obama, you know, vision, or do they want to go Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter? Not to conflate those two, but do they want to go in a more radical populist direction too, or do they want to be the party of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about that a lot on this show, as you might imagine, and you know, we can just look at the Alabama race as an example where, you know, I think Roy Moore is a candidate who will be a big embarrassment to the state of Alabama, to Christians generally. And yet the Democrats have put up a candidate who has a great record, who has a great history.
With the bombings, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. As a civil rights lawyer, I mean, there's a powerful story there. And as I've talked to people close to him, he has a compelling story. But his message hasn't gotten out in a way that would attract Alabama voters. And the clearest example of that is when he was unprepared to answer a question from Chuck Todd on whether he would support any restrictions on abortion, which he said he would not, and has not clarified his stance on that. If anything, he's doubled down. And like you said,
so maybe he was prepared.
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. I've talked with some folks close to his campaign. I think he's in a bit of a situation where if he backs down from the position he said on Meet the Press, then it creates a new news cycle. But that's his responsibility. Understood. That ball's in his court now, and he said what he said. Matt, to your point, that's not the position that Barack Obama had in 2008. That's not the position that successful Democrats have had in national elections or in races like in Pennsylvania or North Dakota or Arkansas, where Democrats have been successful in states that are purple or red. And so it does seem like the Democratic Party is struggling to decide whether whether to sort of go down the center and try and grab as many voters across the ideological spectrum as they could, or whether Trump is actually offering the party an opportunity to move to the left and try and consolidate some ideological gains. You know, for the left, that's all fine and good, but you have to win.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say a couple of things here. And you have to say, like, when I give the Democrats, when I give liberals advice, I sincerely try to give them my sincere advice, but it's fair to point out, you know, oh, he has a conflict of interest. He doesn't want me to win. But you know, in all seriousness, I think a couple things. Like, one thing is they're wrestling with, like, do we want to be as profane and crazy as Trump, or do we want to be the opposite of Trump? And I would vote be the sane party, you know, be right. the opposite. Like maybe people are going to get sick, but you know, was it Tom Perez who wants to curse? And so, then with the life issue, I mean, that's pretty much a deal breaker for me. And so I would have potentially considered voting for a Democrat. I just can't on that issue. Like that's the thing for me. Now, you know, I don't know how many Matt Lewis's there are out there that they could pick up,
right.
You know, like, and probably if they did, they probably do the math and they say like, no, it's not worth it. But just anecdotally speaking, like if Hillary had been, I mean, there was a debate. One of the, you know, they only had, I think they did three debates. There was a debate where Hillary was asked something about the, I hate to admit it. I was sort of leaning toward Hillary at this point. It's crazy for me to admit that. And they asked her about the court.
Yeah.
And she could have said, you know what? I'm going to fight whoever I appoint to the Supreme Court. They're going to interpret the Constitution. And I'm going to pick good judges that'll make you, you know, she could have had that answer.
Right.
No, she said, I'm going to pick people who are going to uphold, you know, Roe versus Wade. Or, you know, and as soon as she said that, like, if I was doing one of those dial tests, I was like, okay, I mean, I guess I'm voting for Trump now, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a major problem. So, you know, we've talked about what's your advice for principled conservatives who have said, you know, the party isn't, at least the president, the White House isn't, you know, welcoming to them right now, but they're willing to stay and fight. How do they fight? What does the fight for the soul of the Republican Party look like for principled conservative?
I think it's just basically a conservative movement in waiting. You know, you know, you need to be the change that you want to see. Be ready when during moments of crisis and opportunity, the baton is passed to people who are prepared. And so I don't know how long this, you know, I don't know when the fever breaks. I don't know if the fever breaks. Political parties sometimes change. Political parties sometimes go away. But all I can do is just keep doing what I believe in, what is right, and stay true to my principles. And I think there are certainly people like Ben Sasse and others who are doing that as well. The danger that the politicians have is, you know, like Sasse is not up for reelection this cycle, but, you know, if the political environment's the same, you know, you're going to have people like Steve Bannon come gunning for him next, you know, when he's up. And there's going to be a temptation for Sasse to sort of change. And there's a chance that someone like Sasse could actually be, as amazing as it is, such a bright star and a principled conservative, that he could be ousted, you know. And if there's a weird, I mean, we saw what happened in Nebraska's not Alabama.
Yeah.
And the last thing I would say, to shamelessly plug this book that's going on 2 years old now, is that there's been Roy Moore is the perfect example of the title "Too Dumb to Fail." The fact that he won that election should now be on the cover. That picture of him in the with the gun, holding up a gun at a rally.
it feels that way.
And so, Matt, you've said that you think Steve Bannon thinks you have to destroy the party to save it. You know, he just wants to kind of pull it apart. What are the odds of his success? You know, how much momentum does he have, and do you think he'll be able to pull that off?
I think there's a chance. I mean, it's easier to destroy things than it is to build things. And you know, and I think Bannon is not, he's certainly not a conservative like in an Edmund Burke sense. I think he's much more of a radical. I think, you know, he's influenced by, you know, I don't know if you guys have read like any of the this is named Joshua Green
book,
But he's influenced by some sort of weird cats. I'm trying to think of the one guy's name. It escapes me right now. But philosophers from the 1930s, Italian, Italian fascist, and at one point he apparently referred to himself as a Leninist or something. He sees the Republican Party and the establishment as corrupt, and rather than trying to reform it or improve it, I think he wants to burn it down. And that is just, that's a radical impulse that's patently unconservative. It's incredibly ironic that he is now considered, a hardcore conservative.
But does it come from nowhere? So I've heard a couple of times you brought up populism kind of purely as a pejorative. And for me, I'm someone who, far from being anywhere near what Bannon's doing or even Sanders, I do have some populist sympathies because I think it comes from somewhere. I think sometimes when the elite have really let down those who are in the the lower classes, for lack of a better term, they react by saying, no, you've done wrong. And so sometimes populism is just a way of holding the elite who have made mistakes, holding them responsible. Can you talk a little bit about that populism? And because it's a fairly broad term, right? There's a lot of ways to go about it. But isn't it somewhat a response to the failures of the elite? Is it always something completely negative and destructive?
Yeah. Wow, this is a great topic. So first, I do think that there is a matter of semantics. Like right now we're talking a lot about nationalism, and I'm for nationalism if it means basically patriotism, right. But there's another connotation in nationalism, which is much more, xenophobic and authoritarian. Right. And I think the same sort of principles that work with populism, if populism means, sort of trusting average Americans, over, pointy headed intellectuals, then that's a pretty good, that's not a bad thing necessarily. But populism quite often ends up, actually being kind of a dark thing where, demagogues exploit the masses, their anger, and, sort of prey upon it, and they usually have to have an enemy, somebody to blame, like immigrants, Jews, you name it. Quite often anti-Semitism eventually becomes part of most populist movements, I would say, to some degree. So it depends, it really depends on what you mean. I think it's one of those things where one person's nationalism is another person's populism. Different. You could say it and mean something very, very different about it. I think that what we're having here is an example of, yes, I think that our elites have failed us for a variety of reasons. I think that some of it is clearly their fault. So, In a representative democracy where you have, elected leaders and you have opinion leaders, they really have a reciprocal responsibility. The public kind of entrusts them to lead the public, but they also need to have the public's interest in mind. And if you look at all of the elite institutions that have failed us, whether it's the Catholic Church sex scandal, whether it is things like Enron or the too big to fail financial crisis, it's very clear that you have these elites who are just looking out for themselves. So, yes, I think that that has invited and opened the door for demagogues like Trump to exploit that opportunity, which I think is really unfortunate. I think that they have invited it. The other thing that's interesting is that Donald Trump talks about how the elites, the establishment is, incompetent and effete and inept. And it sort of is true. But part of the problem is we keep taking power away from them. And so, like, look at the, you know, look at the Republican Party. Like, it used to be that political parties and political institutions had all sorts of statutory and moral authority. And they really could have prevented someone like Donald Trump. There would have been, you know, party bosses and smoke-filled back rooms that would have stopped someone like Donald Trump. But what happens is when party elites and establishment fail us, we punish them by taking away some of their power. So, for example, McCain-Feingold really hurt the political party and their ability to sort of control things with money. We've also taken away the ability of, say, like Paul Ryan, right? You know, the speaker used to have so much more power to reward with earmarks, to reward people, buy them off, basically, to punish people. He doesn't have it. Like, Paul Ryan looks really wimpy and weak. But it's not necessarily just that Paul Ryan's a wuss. Maybe he is, but he also doesn't have half the power that Sam Rayburn had, or even Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Newt Gingrich didn't have to deal with backbench congressmen who could go in front of 24/7 cable news cameras and tweet things and have outside groups like the Club for Growth. And I love the Club for Growth, but outside groups giving them millions of dollars, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a long discussion, but I think you're on to something.
Yeah, we've definitely gone away from that sort of real politic conception. And I think we're starting to see even when it comes to, you know, attaching certain things on, on policy to get it through. We've gone away from that. And I think it's not as practical, right, as it used to be. And so it's hard to get things done.
Yeah. And you could say, OK, if you're a populist, you would say, These politicians, they don't need earmarks. Take away the earmarks. That sounds like a populist, common sense thing to do, but there are unintended consequences. Now, it used to be like if you wanted to actually, I don't know, raise the debt limit or keep the government open, you could buy off some congressmen. It was corrupt, yes, but like it got things done.
Right.
And now I think sometimes, so what happens now is there's more gridlock. And there's more obstruction, and we blame Paul Ryan and we blame Mitch McConnell can't get anything done.
Right.
So it's the elite's fault.
Again,
so we have to let's take more power away from them. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it becomes a catch 22, you know, you keep taking power away from them because they're inept and they look more and more inept.
Yeah,
that's right. And just one last follow-up question. So I think you can look at movements as well, like, you know, Martin Luther King's Poor People's Movement, which was like an aspirational populism, right? Kind of gathering people who were being underserved and had a lack of resources. What is the real? So let's replace what Bannon is doing. And if we could put in place the conservative answer to what's going on in some of these places where people have no jobs, no industry, and they're really suffering, even those who are in this opioid crisis. What is the conservative, real conservative response to that?
Well, to be honest with you, I have no idea what it is. And I don't even know what conservative means anymore. I have my definition. Here's what I think. I think that it's possible, entirely possible, that you could have some populist solutions. Remember, Rick Santorum, when he was running for president, he wanted to have special tax breaks for manufacturing, as an example. So if you're in Ohio, special tax breaks for manufacturing. And, like, I don't know if that's a good policy or a bad policy, but that is a policy question. That's an economic question. And we could debate whether or not, you know, is that bad because it's not free market? Is it bad because it's picking winners and losers? Like, that's a legitimate policy debate. But what it's not is, it's not based on playing the race card. It's not based on stoking division and anger. It's not based on scaring people about immigrants. And that is the part that's the element of the populist Bannon Trump thing that bothers me the most. It's not like whether or not to have a protectionist tariff, right?
Right.
I mean, it's it's the sort of the dark, unseemly stuff that I think is really the most problematic.
Yeah. So Matt, I just want to, I think we're wrapping up here, but you write a lot of on faith and how Christians engage in politics. And of course, this past weekend was the Values Voter Summit, and Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon spoke there and touched on a lot of the themes we've talked about already, of how they've sort of defined their takeover of the Republican Party. But of course, President Trump went and spoke there as well, and he it was really something of a victory lap, and you know, frankly, oddly, you know, a sort of coming home for him, which I think says a lot about the state of you know, a gathering like the Values Voter Summit. He told them that, you know, we are stopping cold the attacks on Judeo-Christian values. He said that, you know, now we're saying Merry Christmas again, which was a return to his campaign trail refrain. And then there were these odd lines, and I noticed these during the campaigns, that, you know, we're really standard family value speech filler, but that just sound kind of outrageous coming from President Trump. So, for instance, he'll say he told the Values Voter Summit that that he supported including increasing the child tax credit and eliminating the marriage penalty because, quote, we know that the American family is the true bedrock of American life, which, you know, sounds one way coming from someone like Mitt Romney or George W. Bush. And, you know, I think should sound a little different coming from someone like Trump. And so were you able to catch President Trump's speech, and what did you think of it? And just generally, what do you think about the state of particularly sort of the conservative white evangelical support for Trump, and how that partnership is looking, you know, 9 months into the Trump administration?
Yeah, so I would say a few things. One, the more I'm in this, the more I'm convinced that the conservative movement is decadent and depraved. You know, there are some really great people in the conservative movement who are true believers, but I would say like half of the leaders, the self-appointed leaders, are phonies. They're not good actors. And that was a very eye-opening and disturbing revelation for me. It took me a long time to sort of discover that. I think it's just, I don't know what Tony Perkins or whoever, what they're thinking. Like, you know, invite the president. I would invite the president.
Right.
I would have invited President Obama.
Yeah.
But Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon, nope. No business being there. That's an embarrassment. That's ridiculous.
Matt, what do you? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I like Eric Erickson had a good, I think, column at Politico pointing that out. I would say I would say this though, sort of in defense, or not even defense, but an explanation of this. Very clearly, the Christian conservative political world has decided we've given up on having someone who is one of us. What we want is someone who will fight for us.
Yep.
And I do think when you look at some of the things that the left says that are incredibly offensive and angry and evil in some cases, I would even say it, you sort of understand it takes two to have a culture war, you know, it takes two to bang.
Right.
And you know, look, I'm not saying it's coming from people like President Obama. Sometimes it's just like a HuffPost blogger who wants to say something crazy on Twitter, but there are things that are said by people from the left that are so infuriating and triggering, use that term, that I think it has sort of galvanized and radicalized people who used to be, you know, compassionate conservatives. Churches ain't saving, they just decorating sinners. When the liquor store's your neighbor, you probably
grow up a drunk. When the courts keep you from court, you probably learn to dump. Well, Justin, we have been talking for a number of weeks about having a guest on who could discuss with us the current state and future of the Republican Party. And I'm just so glad we were able to have Matt on. He brought so much wisdom, and I'm just grateful for the conversation. I thought I know I learned something.
Yeah, it was a solid conversation. And I hope that one thing we did was kind of demonstrate how you can have a constructive conversation and civil conversation with people whom you may disagree on some very significant matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, folks, I would again encourage you to check out Matt's book, Too Dumb to Fail. It really is, I think, more relevant today than it was even when it came out. And so would urge you to check that out. You could always catch Matt on CNN and his column at the Daily Beast. And again, we're grateful Matt came on, and he's now a friend of the show, and hopefully we'll have him on again. Justin, any final words from you, brother?
Hey, let's just move forward, Christians. Stay in your Bible, stay prayerful, and do what you can to make the discourse, our public discourse, better. We will see you next week. I'm grooving for the activists and graduates. I'm an advocate for those feeling abandonment. In the favelas and slums of ghetto inhabitants, it's like, can anything good come out of Nazareth? The only thing good came out of Nazareth. This is the groove, tell me, can you handle it? I'm schooled in the ways of runaway slaves. I'm brave, I'm unchained, I'm Frederick Douglass with a fade. Oh, yeah.